I'm Margaret Feinberg, and this is The Joycast. I don't know if you've spent any time online lately, on websites maybe like Facebook, or perhaps scrolled the comment section beneath a political article. Well, if you haven't noticed, it can get pretty toxic pretty fast. And I don't know about you, but if I'm honest and vulnerable, there are days when I type out a red hot response and click post or send, and then deeply regret it moments later. I recently posted a less than delicate response to someone's post and stomped off to tell Leif how right I was and how wrong that person was. Remember, my husband's eyes closed as he rested his chin on his chest. "What's the matter?" I asked. "That's the last thing that person needs right now," he said. "Their child is in the hospital, and it's not widely known yet, but the person's going through a divorce." Ugh, I felt ill. I raced back to the computer to pull down my comment, but it was too late. The person had already posted a counterattack, one uglier and more personal. It took everything in me not to respond, not to get the last word. I sat down, and just to be honest, my fingers fired like jackhammers. But reflecting on the person's pain, I deleted the post and walked away. I know I'm not the only one who has struggled with the enemy's lie that it's best to get the last word. I mean, if you get the final word, then you win the argument, right? And if you win the argument, that makes you a winner, right? Ugh, I've learned the hard way that you can win the argument and lose the relationship. Because trouncing with that last word can erode feelings of trust and the sense that you're playing fair. See, friends, some words are better left unsaid. In this season of the Joycast, we're following along in my new book, More Power to You, Break Free from Fear and Take Your Life Back. And we're exposing the lies we believe in order to lay hold of the truth of who we are in Christ and all we're called to be. And so if you have not ordered this 52-week devotional and claimed all your free gifts at morepowertoyoubook.com, go ahead, jump online, grab it today. Because the lie that we're looking at today in this episode is one that we're all susceptible to, especially in an election year. And that's, I have to get the last word. Anyone else fallen for that lie? It's a cousin of the lie, my words don't matter. I can say anything I want, online or in person. But if we're honest, we've all lost ourselves in the anger or the excitement of an argument. Possessed by our emotions and pride, all too often we speak too soon, say too much, or speak words we don't really mean. We talk before we think. We blurt the answer before having the whole question. Worse, we often speak the harshest words to those we love most. Yet I believe there is more power to you to break free from this crippling lie, to rise above as a person of grace and strength. And one of the people who embodies that grace and strength is my friend, Scott Sauls. He's senior pastor at Christ Presbyterian Church in Nashville, Tennessee, and such a gift to us all. He's the author of A Gentle Answer, Our Secret Weapon in an Age of Us Against Them. You see, Scott highlights the point that while true faith is filled with holy fire, it is a fire that is meant for refining and healing, as opposed to dividing and destroying. And while that's true of the posts we write and the emails we send, it's even more true of the everyday words we use with our families, our spouses, our kids, and especially ourselves. In today's conversation, you're going to learn how your words have power and how you can look for every opportunity to speak life, show compassion, and bring out the best in others. Scott, it is a joy to have you on the Joycast today.
Thanks, Margaret. It's good to be with you.
Oh my goodness. Your voice, your presence as a pastor and a leader in our generation, your words have fed me and sustained me, and I am so grateful for you.
Wow, that's so kind. That goes both ways, and just really appreciate being able to chat with you today about those things.
Your book is, I think, a challenge to us all. The title of it is A Gentle Answer, and it really addresses so much of the tension, the polarization, the divisiveness that we are facing in our nation and around our world. And I love the subtitle. You title it Our Secret Weapon in an Age of Us Against Them. And I'm curious, where do you think this mentality has come from?
The mentality of polarization.
Yeah. Why has it taken such a strong stance in recent years?
Yeah, I mean, I have an armchair theory that is untested and uninformed. But my theory is that these are issues that have been around ever since the beginning of time, where human beings have been in various ways and in various seasons at each other's throats, canceling each other, calling each other out, not empathizing with each other, being quick to speak and slow to listen because of the good old problem of pride and self-centeredness and self-righteousness, which can often lead to contempt toward the other. And I wonder if, and here's my theory, that was sort of the setup. My theory is the ubiquity of everyone's voice now, because of social media, everybody has a public platform, everybody has a public voice, and to make it even more challenging, rarely will there be any accountability to what people can or cannot say in the public space through social media. And so that's my theory. I don't know how true it is. I don't know if we've gotten worse. I don't know if we've gotten more hostile or not. I personally don't think we have. I just think that we're all being heard more than we used to be able to be heard.
You know, this fall, we've been in this series where we're looking at this, some of the lies that it's easy to believe. And I think one of them is that the lie, you know, I always have to get the last word. Mm. And there's something about engaging in conversations, whether it's online or even in person or even in marriages, where I think it rises up that says, you know, I need to win. I need to get the last word. And yet, I believe what you're writing about is this idea is that is very not the life, the teaching, or the way of Jesus.
It is not. You know, last I checked, it's nowhere in the vision statement of Jesus for his disciples to win, at least not in the way that human beings are accustomed to trying to win. One thing I think that Darwin was spot on about was the theory that everybody is out for their own survival and that the strong dominate the weak and try to win in order to gain more power, more position, more prestige, more self-protection, you know, fill in the blank. And Jesus comes in and reverses all of that and says that the way that you use power in my kingdom is by serving and by getting low and by preferring others above yourself. And even he goes so far as to say to consider others as being more important than yourself and to love all people and all people groups, including those who are in that group called your enemies. And so Jesus upends all of that. But I wonder if he had to speak so strongly in those ways because of the problem of trying to dominate, like you say, and try to win at all costs, sometimes in very unhealthy ways.
And yet in A Gentle Answer, you challenge us to look at our words, the words we say and how we respond. You tell the story of Pete Davidson and Dan Crenshaw. Will you share that with our readers or our listeners?
Yeah, so that's part of the introduction. I think there's a reflection on the life of John Perkins, followed by the anecdote about what went down between the Saturday Night Live comedian and the congressman. And Pete Davidson is not a fan, particularly of Dan Crenshaw's politics, and was, as comedians do, you know, taking comedic shots at Crenshaw on the show. And he went a bit too far and started to said a few words that made fun of Crenshaw's disability. He lost an eye in combat and wears an eye patch, and just kind of made a flippant comment about that. And then there was this massive backlash on social media and wherever else, and it sent Pete Davidson into this, you know, really low place of regret and you know, even self-loathing that he, you know, talked about on his Instagram. And I guess word got to Dan Crenshaw about that, and he reached out to Davidson privately and essentially said, everybody does things they regret. You know, your life has a very significant purpose. You've been given a marvelous platform to steward, et cetera. And then it sort of culminated with Saturday Night Live inviting Crenshaw onto the show to have a conversation with Pete Davidson, and the two kind of shook hands and had a warm exchange. And Crenshaw said some really, you know, kind things about Davidson's father, who died as a firefighter in 9/11. You know, I guess the two thought that the cameras had you know, gone to commercial, but they hadn't yet. And Davidson leans over to Crenshaw and says, "You're a really good man." And that was sort of the end of the story as I tell it in the book. I guess the two have had a couple more interactions since then that have not been so great. But I think Davidson has you know, recanted his affirmations since that time. But so be it, right? In this political climate, I guess that's to be expected. But in any event, it was a beautiful story at the time of its writing,
anyway. And a great example of how disarming gentleness and kindness really, really is. Mm-hmm. I love what you write. You say, "We ourselves, when we become gentle, as we grow thicker skin, handle anger well, receive criticism graciously, forgive all the way, and even bless our own betrayers, the gentle answer has nothing to do with being weak. In fact, it requires the deepest, most courageous, and most heroic kind of faith, the kind that is possible only through the gentle and gentling power of Christ himself."
Yeah. You know, the book is written with Proverbs 15:1 in mind throughout. And that proverb starts with the words, "A gentle answer turns away wrath." And, you know, maybe if there was a word to describe the current American political environment, at least, wrath might be it. Outrage, others have used the word outrage. And, you know, the scriptures say that a gentle answer has incredible diffusing power. And in fact, that's how God won the world, right? It says in the New Testament that while we were still opposed to him, while we were still sinners, while we were still antagonistic toward God, toward Christ, that is precisely when he came and gave his life for us. And, you know, as you know, the self-identified gentle and humble in heart one, he gave his life when we were hostile toward him for our sakes, so that he could freely say to us, "Come to me, all who are weary and burdened," even if we're weird and burdened by our own antagonism and hostilities. So the kindness of God, it also says elsewhere, is what leads us to repentance. It's what leads us to turn toward him and away from whatever hostile ways we may be carrying with us.
I think when we think about the words that we speak, either to each other or online, and online sometimes I feel like it can be a little bit harsher because we feel like there's this invisible screen of protection, which creates a false facade that somehow our words are not as valuable or powerful. In some ways, they're being extenuated so much further online than we could ever have in a one-on-one conversation with another person. But I think there's two kind of pendulums that people can swing to in their one-on-one conversations as well as online. And one is what I have to say doesn't matter. And then the other is that, you know, I always have to get the last word. I always have to win. And yet both are kind of reflections of the same distortion that says that either my words don't have power or they have all the power. But I think Proverbs 18:21 says the tongue has the power of life and of death. And I think you are really challenging us to think about what kind of words are we speaking. For the person who possibly is listening and is thinking, you know what, I've lived my life where I always have to get the last word, or I've lived my life that my words don't really, doesn't matter what I say. So I can really just kind of say whatever I want to say. How do we start breaking free from that? How do we start to experience the transformative power of Christ that begins affecting the words we say and the words we left unsaid?
Well, I think it starts with confronting a very popular lie. We've heard it since childhood, where it goes, sticks and stones may break my bones, but words can never hurt me. There could be nothing less true that a human being could say. I think Psychology Today had a piece where they rewrote that phrase. They revised it to say, sticks and stones may break my bones, but words can cut me deeply. Particularly those who do identify as people of the Bible. All we have to do is remember how our scriptures say everything came to be. It was the power of words that caused the universe to explode into existence. You know, God said, let there be, and there was. And, you know, he does that for six consecutive days. And, he looks back and he sees that everything that he had made with his words, meaning the universe, the galaxies, the stars, the skies, the planets, fingertips and earlobes, all of it, he made with words. And, it was words that Jesus used to call a dead man out of the grave in John's gospel. And, the Apostle Paul says the gospel, which is essentially bound up in words, is the power of God for salvation for those who believe, first for the Jew, then for the Gentile. And so it's all over the scriptures for those who believe the scriptures, that words are immensely powerful for good, and they can be immensely powerful for destruction. And, and that's the great thing about this conversation is we, just as much as we can talk about how deeply words can hurt and injure, we can also talk about how powerful words are to encourage and to build up. Anne Boskamp, who I think is a mutual friend of ours, right, Margaret? So she has this wonderful phrase that kind of sums it up. She says, only speak words that make souls stronger. I just love that. And she's a master at that, as you are, being able to steward the gift of words in ways that are life-giving instead of life-diminishing is a glorious gift. And it's also just a treasure of an opportunity. And you don't have to be as gifted of a writer as you or Anne. All you have to do is say words like Mr. Rogers used to say on Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood every episode, I like you. I mean, how powerful are those words? I like you, or I love you, or that was great. We talk at our church a lot about, eulogies, right? When we're remembering somebody at a funeral, everybody who gets up, they think of something great to say about the person. And so we talk at our church about the importance of offering living eulogies. Don't wait till somebody dies to start saying kind things about them, because guess what? They can't hear you when they're in a casket, but they can hear you when they're still with you. And speak those words not only for your healing, which is what we do at funerals. But speak those words for the healing of the person you're talking about as well. Words are powerful. Here ends my speech. You hit a button. You hit a button on that one. And I went off to the races. Sorry about that.
So
now
good.
Tell me what you think, Margaret. What do you think about words?
Yeah, no, I agree with everything you just said. I couldn't even just herald that more. It's interesting because I think the power of what you're saying of, I like you, I love you. Like when we start to think about transformation and transforming our words, like long before you ever reach for your phone or your computer, I think those words begin at home. And whether that's with your roommate or your children, or your spouse or your mother or your grandparents, whatever that may be. When I married my husband Leif early in his in our marriage, he would start speaking just words over me. And it would just be a little, it'd be a little comment in like in the morning, you know, I love living this life with you. Mm. And he would say it one day and another day and another day. And, you know, 60, 120, 800 days later. And we kind of would pass back almost like a little chorus each day of, there's no one I'd rather do this life with. I love you, but I really, really like you. And those words of affection and affirmation, and it becomes almost like a song that you sing, and you can sing that song over your spouse, over your friends, over your children. And then I think it is, we practice it, it does become easier to speak over others.
Yes, truly. I mean, it's like anything. It's like all, you know, all ways, you know, that we're formed. We're formed as, you know, athletes by getting in shape and practicing our skill. We're formed as writers by writing. We're formed as believers by, you know, getting in community and reminding ourselves of things that are, you know, true and beautiful. We're formed as affirmers by affirming. we're formed as encouragers by encouraging. And it can be clunky and awkward because it feels very vulnerable to look to say, especially when you're the one going first. It feels very vulnerable to say, I like you, I love you, because those words sadly are so rare. and yet when you start to experience the power of what those kinds of words can create in a relationship and the healing power it can have for not only the person you're saying them to, but also for you as you're saying them, it just, the more contagious it becomes, the more wonderful it becomes. What a great thing that your husband, you said the 800 something days. That's like that's almost 3 years. That's really fantastic. That's actually something that I started doing with our girls from their youngest years. Was I would, at bedtime, and we'd call it the benediction, because kind of the benediction is the last thing you pronounce at the end of a worship service in our tradition. So we thought, well, the last thing we pronounce over our kids each day will be a benediction, which is Latin for good word. And, you know, would just pronounce an affirming word over our girls with my hand on their head. And I think for every mistake I've made as a father over the years, and they've been many, I think those mistakes in large part are overcome by sort of the repeat affirmation of how much a treasure they are. So I think you guys are on to something, and I hope whoever's listening to this would practice similar things that you're doing, because it is powerful.
It's one thing to do in our home, but it's another thing to do in that hot, hot moment when you just saw that Facebook post and that person said that thing, or that person, it felt like they were attacking you and maybe they sent you a text or an email, or they said that thing in the moment. And at times we want to rise up and be right. We, you know, the Pharisee in us, we want to shut that down. What kind of stops can we put in our life before we just spew right back?
Oh boy, I'm not going to say that I'm the best practitioner of anything I'm about to say, Margaret, but one thing that I so admire about Tim Keller, who, you know, I worked with Tim for about 5 years in New York at Redeemer. And Tim, you know, is a very public person. And, you know, as often is the case with public people, he would get his I call it his unfair share of criticism. Tim's the kind of person too, because he's kind of one of those third way people who empathizes with and tries to see, you know, kernels of truth and beauty, you know, that you can kind of cherry pick from every perspective. And because of that, he often gets mischaracterized he's been criticized a lot more for things that he doesn't believe, for believing things that he doesn't believe than for things that he actually does believe and teach. So, you know, that's kind of that extra level of maddening, the way that he would, this is the amazing thing. For over the course of 5 years, I never witnessed him retaliate, for any kind of behavior like that. I never witnessed him bad mouthing another person, even behind closed doors in private. I never witnessed a moment of self-pity. And what his practice was, he actually got from John Newton, the old, you know, London pastor who, you know, was famous for writing Amazing Grace and helping Wilberforce have the courage to fight for the abolition of the slave trade, right? So one thing John Newton did on a regular basis was that he would write letters, and there's this profuse collection of the letters of John Newton, and he'd write them to younger ministers. And one of the letters is titled On Controversy. And in that letter, it says, when you've been criticized, including when you've been criticized unfairly, the first thing to do is to get low and ask the Lord if there is a kernel of truth somewhere in even the unfair criticism, so you'll have something to repent of and receive the grace of Jesus Christ for afresh. And then get up from that moment and address it however you must, but start there. And that was Tim's practice. And it was remarkably beautiful to watch and remarkably convicting as well, because I can't say that that's usually my first impulse, but like we said before, it comes with practice though. You know, the more you do it, the more natural it feels. And so
it does. And I feel like in this season, we have a lot of opportunities to practice, in this crazy pandemic world where systems and what was familiar, something as simple as ordering a product is now can take weeks, months, get lost, mail shutdown, all different kinds of things. And I think one of the practical places, in addition to our family and online, but is also just recognizing those who are on the other end of receiving your customer service. It's a very practical and very basic, but how recognizing you're not writing a company, you're writing a person at the end of the day. And that a little bit of kindness I have been discovering can just go a long way. And I realized that in the past, I'd be like, well, I don't have my product. I don't da da da. And yet saying, hey, I know there's a lot going on. Can you help me track this? Can you, but putting that, even just the gentle words in something as simple as responding to a clerk or a customer service agents can just be just life-giving.
Yeah. And I think another one, another component to that in frustrated moments, like what you're describing, a friend of mine has this word and the word is assumicide, where we kill other people in our hearts with our assumptions about what their motives are, about why they've let us down, and oftentimes it's either that, you know, we didn't let our desires and expectations be known, and this especially happens in things like marriages and families and churches even. But the other thing too is, and I love this, the way that the movie and the book Wonder ends with this statement, which is a real, really important, I think, humbling gut check when we're in conflict, where it says that, you know, be kind because every person you meet is fighting a hard hidden battle, or as they say, hurting people hurt people. And you know, so even if you're in conflict and you're confronted with somebody who might be behaving offensively, you know, to remember that this human being isn't just offensive, they're also damaged. And so there's the compassion element that can come into play. And that doesn't mean we won't, you know, argue back or, you know, stand our ground if we need to. Sometimes it's very appropriate to stand our ground, especially if there's bullying going on or abuse or hurtful behavior, it's entirely appropriate to stand your ground. I think what I'm talking about more is like we need to be reluctant to try to get a pound of flesh out of the other person through retaliation. And sometimes just, trying to lean into that empathic space that everybody's got a story behind who they are and why they, act like they do.
That's true. And I think also kind of playing off of this is this idea that before we respond, definitely the compassion, the understanding, not performing. And I love that word, a suicide. I think I'm very guilty of a suicide. I think probably all of us struggle with that. But it's also recognizing the words that formulate in our minds and in our hearts that we want to spew out often reveal so much about the state of our own hearts. I love your chapter called He Reforms the Pharisee in Us, that sometimes it's in how we want to respond or sometimes how we do that exposes the pharisaical side that is in all of our hearts. And none of us want to be a Pharisee, but I think if we're honest, I know for myself, it's in me. I don't like it. I don't want it. But it still is that moment of exposure that says, God, I have something inside of me that needs to change, that I must repent from, that I need to be broken free from.
Yes. What does it say in Luke 18? To some who trusted in themselves that they were righteous and looked down on other people with contempt. And then Jesus tells the parable of the Pharisee and the tax collector. And, it's the tax collector that goes home whole. And the only difference between the two is they have a similarity. They're both judging the tax collector. and the tax collector, the tax collector is the one who goes home whole, because he starts with, what Christ called the plank in the eye, instead of the speck in somebody else's eye. I think it's also intuitive as well. People who are humble, especially people whose default is to move toward humility in the middle of conflict, are just so incredibly disarming and endearing and effective in conflict and persuasive in conflict. That's a whole irony of it. Like if we really want to persuade someone of our side, aggression is like the worst, least effective way of persuading somebody. And kindness and humility is incredibly persuasive. But we've got to deal with pride in order to get there.
Earlier this year, I had a couple conflicts and was just praying about them and just going, God, what do I do? And the word I sensed the Holy Spirit say was lose. Just lose. Don't try to win. Just, it doesn't matter. It's unjust. It doesn't matter. It's not right. Just lose. I was like, okay. But it was so surprising. And yet it was so freeing just to say, you know what? It's not right. And I can absorb this that is not right. I can absorb not having to win, not having to be right, not having to, but to just go, okay. And at times I think I want to be very clear not to be a doormat, not to be abused, not to be bullied, not those things. But there are some things in life we don't need to win. And sometimes the path to freedom is just saying, you know what, I'm going to lose this one and that's okay.
Yeah. And I love that you put it in those terms as well, because not getting the last word is conceding a loss, which is actually one of the strongest internal things that human beings can do, is to concede a loss, even if we happen to be right, which is often what happens. The more mature person, who is probably more in the right, ends up being the one to say, okay, and takes a lot of power. I've wondered too, like Christ on the cross, talk about the ultimate loss, like the Romanian missionaries, refer to Christ as God the loser, and that's not an insult. It's high praise that he had the fortitude. I don't know what took greater strength from Christ to come up from the dead, or to not retaliate when he was being crucified so unjustly. And yet, here we are, 2.5 billion people following him now and living today and counting, because of both of those displays of power, the cross and the resurrection.
And as he goes, so should we. For our listeners who want to learn more about you, Scott, and your book, where should they go?
Anywhere. Amazon, Barnes & Noble, the usual suspects, a lot of local bookstores as well. Or you can just go to my website, scottsauls.com. They're actually free excerpts. Don't buy the book until until you're convinced you want to read the whole thing. I think there's actually a free excerpt of every book I've written on the books page of my website, scottsauls.com. And then, you know, people can decide whether or not they want to be all in with any of the projects. But yeah, A Gentle Answer is the latest one.
And I'm going to just overstep my boundaries here and be like, guys, you're going to love Scott's writing and books. They are so stinking good.
Oh, you're so kind. Thank you, Margaret. Appreciate
that. Thank you, Scott. Thank you so much for being with us today on the Joycast.
My pleasure.